Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today we have a special feature called Poets Theater. I'm giving over the hour to the acclaimed poet Annie Finch, who's going to present a live performance from New York City of an excerpt from her play entitled Among the Goddesses. Here's Annie Finch.
Hello, I'm Annie Finch. What you're about to hear are two excerpts from my choreo poem, Among the Goddesses, published by Red Hen Press in 2010. In the prologue, you'll hear four voices, a young woman named Lily, and three priests of the goddess. Lily is just about to begin the journey that will bring her face to face with living embodiments of several ancient goddesses.
Invocation. One plume of salt spray thrown up by a rock face, one pebble left on the shore where it lands. There is no end if there was no beginning, so help me to tell where this ending began. Gathering women who touch, who honor, who loom traditions through the body of earth, please lend me your voices and some of our stories to spiral this shell through the layers of sand. When it began, I was traveling onward. One pebble left on the shore where it lands. One plume of salt spray thrown up by a rock face.
One plume of salt spray thrown up by a rock face. There is no end if there was no beginning.
There is no end if there was no beginning. One plume of salt spray thrown up by a rock face.
One plume of salt spray thrown up by a rock face. One pebble left on a shore where it lands.
Gathering women who touch, who honor, who loom traditions through the body of earth. There is no end if there was no beginning. So help me to tell where this ending began. Gathering women who touch, who honor, who loom traditions through the body of earth.
Please lend me your voices and some of your stories to spiral this shell through the layers of sand.
To spiral this shell through the layers of sand. When it began, I was traveling onward.
When it began, she was traveling onward.
The next scene takes place much later, and a lot has happened to Lily in the meantime. In her travels, she has met the goddesses Eve, Isis, and Astarte, and has been welcomed and loved by them. But when she spends the night alone in a churchyard, she's attacked and brutally raped by a crazed fanatic who calls her a witch. Later, when Lily meets Hecate, Greek goddess of the crossroads, she realizes she is pregnant. Now Lily has made the difficult decision not to carry the baby. She finds the house belonging to Kali, Hindu goddess of creation and destruction, who makes a potion for her to drink. Lily is locked into a small, darkened room, waiting for the potion to take effect. Surrounding her are hundreds of statues of the goddess. After the priests, the first voice you hear will be Kali.
Isis, Astarte, Diana, Hecate, Demeter, Kali, Inanna.
All night she half slept, nauseous, scared, not quite alone, listening to movement in her belly.
staring into the room's huge night at her guardian, the hollow-eyed giant
called Inanna, with robes like the sky.
She looks right at me, with eyes that swallow. Hours and hours of darkness fall into her eyes.
Inanna. Then it was morning. She must have slept, finally.
Dawn pressed hard at her through the trees.
I'm more nauseous. Not even hungry.
The door was locked and the house stayed quiet all day.
I don't even think she is here. Lying down, I knew I would stay there, with the eyes of the centuries on me, longer than a century. All night I half slept, nauseous, scared, but not quite alone, listening to movement in my belly, reaching constantly with my eyes, staring into the room's huge night at my guardian, the hollow-eyed giant called Inanna, with robes like the sky. So my hunger and sickness kept me.
Two more nights and three more days.
Weak but wakeful. I could see them. In the darkness, she looked right at me, with eyes that swallowed. Hours and hours worth of darkness fell into her eyes. I could tell it was she, from the bull's horns that surmounted her face like the moon, and the fearless concentration she stood still with, her towering focus.
Two more nights and three more days.
They can see me. They can see me.
Dozens.
Watching her with eyes, squatting goddesses with children or alone, alabaster or dark burned stone, mouths sometimes open, sometimes in pain, chipped out hollows shadowing distance, inset eyes of turquoise staring.
And the queen of heaven, Inanna, never left her eyes alone.
Hard on the beams of her eyes I went downward, till that day passed. An evening came, and into the second night's solitude
there rose another terrible queen. Then it was morning. I guess she'd slept, finally. Dawn pressed hard at her through the trees.
I was more nauseous, not even hungry, but I stood up and pushed at the door, wanting distraction. There were no distractions. The door was locked, and the house stayed quiet all day. I don't even think she was there.
So those statues were her companions. Two more nights and three more days.
As my hunger and sickness kept me weak but wakeful, I could see them.
Dozens, watching her with eyes, squatting goddesses with children or alone, alabaster or dark burned stone, mouths sometimes open, sometimes in pain, chipped out hollows, shadowing distance, inset eyes of turquoise staring from attenuated heights.
And the queen of heaven, Inanna, never left my eyes alone. Hard on the beams of her eyes I went downward, till that day passed. An evening came, and into the second night's solitude there rose another terrible queen. She stood over me with the height of a murderer, her hand on my belly, her voice in my blood.
Eresh Kagal! Eresh Kagal!
While Inanna watched without one movement.
Till the dawn came, I felt that hand burning, and I knew the flame. She stood over me with the height of a murderer, her hand on my belly, her voice in my blood. While Inanna watched me without one movement. Till the dawn came, I felt that hand burning, and I knew the flame
was spinning heavy out from her forehead, resting between her eyes like new wisdom as her pregnancy shrank and contracted. Inanna had taken her to the vision, and she held her there till it was over under Eresh Kagal's hand. They all saw her as death moved through her, and she took a life. So many of them, without pity or fear, massed on the shelves with their eyes wide open.
As death moved through me, and I took a life, as my pregnancy shrank and contracted.
As death moved through her, and she took a life, Inanna had taken her to the vision, and she held her there till it was over.
As death moved through her, and she took a life, as her pregnancy shrank and contracted, Inanna had taken her to the vision, and she held her there till it was over, under Ereshkigal's hand. They all saw her as death moved through her, and she took a life. So many of them, without pity or fear, massed on the shelves with their eyes wide open.
Isis Astarte, Diana, Hecate, Demeter, Kali, Inanna. Death moved through her, and she took a life. Death moved through her, and she took a life.
She waited till evening, with Inanna's eyes on her, steady as the sun she ruled the day.
Death moved through her, and she took a life.
All I wanted was there.
Day and its lover,
night and its lover,
brought by Inanna.
They healed the pain.
In the gray light, she left the room.
By the third morning, weak and thirsty, no longer nauseous, I lay in a daze, waiting for Kali. I waited till evening, with Inanna's eyes on me, steady as the sun, she ruled the day, and stopped at dusk. All I wanted was there, day and its lover, night and its lover, brought by Inanna. They healed the pain. In the gray light, I left the room.
Thank you for listening. The part of Lily was read by Rainer Judd. Kali was read by Kate Johnson. The Caretes, Priests of the Goddess, were read by Sam Barnes, Julian Brand, and Zachary Luke. The music was recorded live at the Temple of Isis in Egypt by Laura Iaccarino. The production was directed by Kate Johnson.
So thank you. And now we have a chance to actually talk with one of our most important formal poets, Annie Finch. We have some great questions and answers that we'd like to share with you. And so, first of all, because, Annie, you are one of the country's leading formal poets, you have several anthologies that are used widely in colleges and universities all across the company, and you have several books to your credit. Why goddesses? What do the ancient goddesses offer to us today?
The goddesses offer a balance and an alternative to the predominant religion, the Judeo-Christian Abrahamic religions based on patriarchal rule. And more specifically, I think the goddesses offer a chance to honor the physical world and the physical body as completely sacred. For women and for men who are hurting from the weakening of the feminine force on our planet, the goddesses offer a chance to honor the divine feminine in all of us. They offer a chance to honor the sacred in nature, and a chance to be joyous, to be joyously human and joyously mortal.
So how did you come to discover the whole concept of the goddess?
I was born on Halloween, and that probably got me off to
marked for life.
Kind of magical start. And I think all through my life, I was aware that there was something, there was a spiritual possibility that no one was quite aware of in my family growing up, and yet that was always on the edges. My mother used to hold full moon parties where we would dance and listen to opera, and there was just a feeling that there was always a search going on. My father was looking, was a student of religions and a teacher of world religions, and I always felt that they were looking as well, constantly. I think the first time I really became aware of the possibility of the divine feminine was when I studied with Entezake Shange in graduate school, and she is famous for saying, "I found God in myself and I loved her fiercely." And I think Zaki for me was an embodiment of the living goddess, of a way that one could live a life in accordance with the goddess. And I began to write mythological poetry and to develop my own sort of theology almost. And after I got to a certain point with that, I began to meet other people who were interested in the goddess, and it was as if I were coming home.
Yeah, you realized you weren't alone.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Right. So how was Among the Goddesses shaped by your own experience, or was it?
It was very much. The original idea came from, I think one of the original seeds came from a conversation I had with my father. And I had always loved mythology, and I had grown up loving legends and fairy tales and epics and ancient tales, and I wanted to write an epic on my own. And I was probably a freshman in college, and I mentioned this to my father, and he said very strongly, "Women can't write epic. It's impossible, because it's about heroism, and women don't understand that. And women are about connectedness, and they don't really understand the concept of the individual heroic journey." So, of course, I decided right there that I would write one. And years later, I finally got the nerve to write it. In the interim, I was mulling it over in the back of my mind, and I began to realize that an epic would have to be about abortion if it was going to be a feminist epic, or an epic that sought to reclaim spiritual power for women. I understood that this was a key point where women needed to claim our own power, our own spiritual authenticity, and that as long as we allowed abortion to be defined by the Judeo-Christian tradition, we would never really claim our full power as women. So I determined to write an epic about abortion, and it was Hecate came to me first, the scene with Hecate, where Hecate visits Lily, and she is the goddess of the crossroads and the triple goddess. She's an aspect of the triple goddess, the dark, powerful goddess. And she was the first one who came to me. And then gradually I put the story together. And it was shaped by my experience finally, because I finally did have an abortion after I had finished the first version of the story. And I had my own abortion, and for about a year afterwards, I was in so much pain and I couldn't reconcile myself with it, and it was starting to really hurt my life in a lot of ways, and I felt very alone, as if I was carrying this incredible burden, and I didn't have any connection with anyone else to share it with. And then one day I understood that I needed a ritual that would help me to heal from this, and that I would make this ritual, and that my family would be part of it with me, because really we had all been through this together. And so I wrote a ritual, which is now the ritual at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. And we did the ritual together, and my two children were part of it, and it was a very beautiful experience, really, very powerful for our family, very sober, very deep, and also totally healing. And after that experience, I was never bothered by it again. In the same way, I felt that I was fully healed from it. So the book really came into its own. There were some strange coincidences where I had a publisher for the book years and years earlier, but I withdrew it from publication and decided not to publish it. And then it was only after I had had my own abortion and I wrote this ritual that the publication really began to come together, and then I put the ritual at the end of the book.
Right.
And I felt that really completed the book because it allows someone to read it, and maybe the feelings that come up about abortion during the process of reading the book, then there's something to do with them, a way to deal with them.
Great. I think your experience of feeling very alone was more common than not among women who have had to go through that. And it's a wonderful thing now that people are beginning to write about it and sharing ways toward healing about it. So your book, your choreo poem, is certainly a part of that, which is really great. And so how do you feel about a connection between poetry and the healing from trauma?
On so many levels, I think poetry helps us heal from trauma. And this was true for me from the beginning of my life, really. I didn't even, before I realized how much I had been wounded by verbal abuse and later by incest, I don't think I knew that the poetry was healing me, and yet poetry was what I sought out because it brought me to a place of a kind of rhythmic healing, a place of safety, a place where my mind and my body would be balanced together. And I think that's what poetry can really provide for us, particularly because of the rhythm, the way that poetry gives us a physical rhythm for our mental thoughts and our emotional feelings. It allows us to integrate and harmonize all the different aspects of us. And I think it also connects us with each other through the same process of rhythm, and also with nature, because the rhythm, the frequency that connects us is what makes us all united. And as in yoga, it's the union that creates the healing. So I think poetry can heal us in this way, as really nothing else can. And it's partly through the subject matter and partly through just the form, just the process of poetry.
Yeah, even physiologically, it seems that the rhythm of poetry, I think they've proven that it lowers blood pressure, it lowers the heartbeat, it induces deep relaxation. I think that's why mothers have been singing soothing, rhyming, you know, nursery rhymes or lullabies to their children.
Exactly. Yeah, there are some wonderful studies about that. Heart attack victims heal much, much faster if they recite poetry in meter. And yeah, there's such a universal ratio between the heartbeat and the breath, which is reflected in the poetic line across all cultures. And it just reminds us, I think.
Well, that makes me think of something that I'm sure everyone that heard this piece noticed, and that is that the script has an incantation-like quality, that there is a rhythm to it, and there's also a lot of repetition, and it's like a spell. And I really would love to hear you talk about relating poetry and magic. So how does that work? Poetry and magic, is there a connection? And how do you define magic?
Magic for me is changing reality through a recalibration of ourselves. And poetry allows us to do that through the kind of rhythmic power I was talking about earlier. And also, I think even in the process of revising poetry, Yeats said, when I revise a poem, it is myself that I remake. So that's another way I think that it can heal us and allow us to create magic and create change in the world through the process of revising something and making it strong. The connection between poetry and magic is so universal and so ancient. And in the Celtic cultures, the bards were able to do things that the kings couldn't do. I mean, they were able to wear special robes and do special things that nobody else could do. And I think especially in an oral culture, when you don't have writing, the power of the poet is so much greater because the poet connects us back through history through the memory of things that are carried on sometimes orally for generations and generations without ever being written down. So the poet is also the repository of all the lore and all the knowledge. And again, it's the meter that helps that to happen. So there's this association of poetry with the wisdom and with healing. And if you put those two things together, in a way, that's magic, isn't it? Wisdom and healing together.
I've always thought of it, too, like a spell or a recipe. You know, if you have a formal poem that has to have a certain number of syllables and a certain rhyme scheme, that's almost like having to follow a recipe.
Exactly.
And you have to plug your thought and your intention into that form, and there's a discipline to it, but there's also a magic to it.
Yeah, or like a yoga pose or something like that. Yeah, it's it's no coincidence that, you know, a spell in Harry Potter or wherever, or on Bewitched, a spell always has to have rhythm and rhyme to it.
Right, exactly. So because you use a lot of very powerful repetition in your poetry, could you read us another example of a poem that uses magical repetition?
Sure. I'll read a poem that is written for the time of Lammas, which happened just a couple of days ago, in early August, the time of the harvest, of the first harvest. And it's a time of appreciating what we've harvested so far and then preparing for what's going to come next, for the rest of the harvest. And a lot of my poems that use repetition are meant to be performed by many voices or one voice. So I'll just read it alone, but you could also imagine it in different voices. Lammas chant. Fill the earth's belly full. Fill the earth's belly full. Bring the food, bring the grain. There are cold months ahead. Give them peace in the ground. Bring the food, bring the grain. Fill the earth's belly full. Bring the food, bring the grain. There are cold months ahead. Give them peace in the ground. There are cold months ahead. Give them peace in the ground. Fill the earth's belly full. Bring the food, bring the grain. There are cold months ahead. Give them peace in the ground.
In cultures that live closer to the earth than we do, because we, as we know, buy most of our food at the supermarket, but in agricultural cultures where people had to live by the cycles of the season, Lammas was the time when you could really feel the power of the sun having gone into the earth and into the grain. And so your poem kind of echoes that in a really beautiful way, the power of the earth and the sun having gone into what's going to feed us in the cold months to come. It's great.
One thing I love about writing with repetition is the way the same words can be changed by where they happen, and the meaning can change. So that's kind of like the process of magic at work, the transformation of the same word into different meanings depending on where it happens and how it happens.
So let's take a short break, and then we'll come back with our interview of Annie Finch. So we're back talking live with poet Annie Finch. We just heard an excerpt from her choreo poem, Among the Goddesses, which featured a very powerful abortion scene. And I just want to say, Annie, it takes a lot of courage to write with such clarity and frankness and strength about that subject. And I would imagine that you've also gotten some flack for being out as a pagan. Is that true? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I have a little. Not as much as I had feared, certainly. I think there's been more benign neglect than flack overall. But yeah, there have been some occasions where I had to overcome some fear about it. There was a colleague at work that I was involved in a little bit of a conflict with, threatened to actually go to the the people where I work and like and tell them that I was a pagan as if this was some bad thing, like that would be a problem. I mean, you know, we have religious freedom, but I noticed that I was afraid of this, and that's one reason that I think I started to come out more forcefully, because it just seemed very wrong to me that someone's spiritual path could be held over their head as something to threaten them with. And that may have been a factor in why I decided to come out more openly as a pagan. And I did that by starting a blog called American Witch, where I blog about life and about my ideas or about the seasons of the year from a pagan point of view, things like that. But I became so appreciative of people who were out as pagans during that time when I was feeling afraid that I realized I needed to come out as well, just to make things that much easier for everyone else.
And you're going to have a book out before much longer, I think, and it has the same title as the blog, American Witch. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That book, I'm writing it now. It's a spiritual memoir and the story of how I came to be a witch.
I'd like to know more about that. That's great.
But I have, you know, for a while I have come out in my poetry, but it's a little different to come out in prose. I think people take it more seriously. When you write prose, they think you're really telling the truth. But as a poet, they're always willing to give you more leeway as a poet to be metaphorical. Right. But my book Calendars, my book of poetry Calendars, has a lot of pagan things in it. The Lamas poem that I read earlier is in there, and many poems for the Wheel of the Year or poems that reflect my pagan beliefs. And my selected poems is coming out in the spring, and that's called Spells. So that goes back to what you were talking about earlier, the connection.
Right. I would actually love for you to read another goddess-centered poem or two.
I have a couple of poems here from my book Eve, which is a book centered on goddesses. It was actually my first book. And I'll read a couple of poems from a sequence of goddess poems in that book. These were performed as dance pieces as well as sung, and I like them probably best on the page. And there are 9 poems in the series, and each one has a form that connects with the culture of that particular goddess. So I'll read Brigid, which is in a Celtic form, a very complex one. And it's for the goddess Brigid. She's the goddess of poetry and also the goddess of smith work, which connects, of course, to the rhythms of meter.
And healing.
And also the goddess of healing, the poetry healing connection. Brigid. Ring, 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 hammers fall. Your gold will all be beaten over sudden flaming fire moving from you. The pyre. Sweeten your cauldron until the sun runs with one flame through the day, and the healing water will sing, linger on tongues, burn away. And another poem in this sequence is about Eve, who I consider to be a goddess.
I love that.
That gets us all a goddess right there, and us all in Western religious background cultures, a goddess right there at the beginning. And I think there is quite a bit of thought now that Eve was descended in many ways from the fertility goddesses of the Mediterranean. And this is in the sonnet form, which seemed appropriate for the Western goddess. When Mother Eve took the first apple down from the tree that grew where nature's heart had been, and came tumbling, circling, rosy into sin, which goddesses were lost and which were found? What spirals moved in pity and unwound across our mother's body with the spin of planets lost for us and all her kin? What serpents curved their mouths into a frown, but left their bodies twined in us, like threads that lead us back to her? Her presence warms, and if I follow closely through the maze, it is to where her remembered reaching spreads in branching gifts. It is to her reaching arms that I reach, as if for something near to praise.
There's such a wonderful movement afoot, sort of revisioning some of the great myths that have traditionally been patriarchal. I'm thinking, for instance, about the Arthurian legends and how that was revisioned in Mists of Avalon to be more feminized. And I'm seeing with the Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ story, with the Passion of Mary Magdalene by Elizabeth Cunningham, a revisioning of that whole story. And you're doing this with Eve as well. I think that's really great to reclaim a different way of looking at something we've grown up with.
Exactly. It's interesting you mention Elizabeth Cunningham, because she and I are both fellows together at the Black Earth Institute. And the Black Earth Institute is really a wonderful, progressive kind of think tank, started by Patricia Monahan, who's been a major factor in bringing the myths back. And I think one of the first steps is just to become aware of the myths that have been lost or forgotten. And then to reclaim them is almost a natural response, because they're just so exciting. It's been that way for me over and over.
Yeah, I remember years ago first discovering that there was a time when God was a woman. And no one had told me that. And to rediscover through people like Gim Butas and her archaeological research, and Patricia Monahan's The Book of Goddesses and Heroines, it was so empowering and enlivening as a woman to realize that once females were considered sacred, not you know, the cause of all the problems.
Exactly.
Right, that's great.
And you've done so much in your own writing to make the sacredness of women a part of our daily lives.
Thanks. So let's change gears just a little. As well as everything else that you're doing, you're also the director of the Stone Coast MFA in Creative Writing Program, where students come from all over the world to the Stone House in Maine for two residencies a year. I know a little bit about Stone Coast myself. So can you describe the experience of Stone Coast a little bit, and what makes it maybe different from some of the other low residency programs in the country, aside from the fact that it's rated in the top 10?
There are some magnificent people at Stone Coast, faculty, visitors, students. And I think one of the things that knits the program together and makes it such a powerful writing community is the fact that there are many people there who do understand the connection between creativity and the human spirit. So there are people from many different paths, many different spiritual inclinations, or no particular spiritual inclination, and yet I think they all understand the connection between the heart and the spirit and the creative power. The ways that opening yourself psychically to connection with nature and with other people and with your own soul can connect you to a great flood of creative energy. So it's a very inspiring place. As a low residency community, it means that people come together twice a year for about 10 days and share very intense writing workshops, readings, classes, events, seminars. There's a lot of sharing going on, a lot of thinking, a lot of writing, a lot of creative work. And then people can go home for 6 months and work one-on-one with a faculty mentor to develop their writing before coming back again. So it's a really magnificent two-year program, and it changes people's lives, and I love being part of it. And I'd never have had a job that where I felt such a direct connection between my artistic self and my human self and my work life. So I appreciate it very much being part of it.
It's very integrated. One thing I've noticed, too, is that unlike some writing programs where this shark-like competitiveness rules the day, at Stone Coast, while there's great academic rigor, there's this wonderful sense of community and encouragement for each other, and people form friendships that last lifelong.
Yeah, that's very, very true. So it's helping to make the world a better place through the connections between people, as well as through the development of people's creative voices. And there are some fantastic writers coming out of that program. We do value craft very much there as well, and I don't think that's a coincidence that at the same time as there's such a strong sense of community and fun, that almost is a balance to a real focus on the nuts and bolts of the craft. So the poets all need to learn about meter and rhythm and all those magical, fundamental, ancient aspects of the art. And the fiction writers are focusing on the craft of story. So it's a wonderful balance. And I think through all of my life, I have a PhD in literature, so I've had to develop the mind quite a bit. And I've found that doing that developing in one direction, if you're aware of balance, then it can lead you to develop in another direction to balance it out, so that you can actually become more creative through developing your mental capacities or something like that. And I think that's kind of something that we're doing at Stone Coast as well, because there's a lot of really intelligent thinking going on about literature and writing, and that seems to free people to be more free and relaxed, which is sort of the opposite of the stereotype in this country. The stereotype is that if you have fun and everything is easy and superficial, that makes you more open and relaxed, but actually I think it's the opposite.
One of the things I love too about Stone Coast is the cross-pollination that goes on between genres. So funnily enough, that kind of leads me to my next question. As well as a poet, you also obviously do theater work. We just heard an excerpt from your choreo poem, and you have actually founded a group called the Poets Theater. So can you tell us a little bit about that and how it started?
Well, today's production is a Poets Theater production, and Poets Theater is focused on bringing poetry into connection, deep connection with its roots in music, in magic, in community. So bringing poetry off the page and into people's lives and into the life of the spirit and of the active, conscious human being. And bringing this to the spring poetry to the stage really helps this to happen. We've done some productions that involve reading poetry. And then we've done one very elaborate stage production with dance and masks and movement and choreography, and that was called The Wolf Song. It was a play that I wrote, and I'm really excited about it and excited about doing more such things. I think we'll be doing some work with Yeats plays as well, and it's just bringing poetry to the stage in all of its rhythm and all of its magic. So it's kind of a ritual theater, and also maybe a shamanic theater or a folk theater. And I know that you've done some work with that as well, so you understand where I'm coming from.
I think there's a real interest in that kind of thing now, more than ever. I think people are wearying somewhat of the soullessness of so much of the big media productions, and are wanting to find something juicier, something more integrated with spirit.
Yeah, and I love the theater because it allows people to remember that poetry really is supposed to be fun. I mean, it wouldn't have survived for all these millennia if it weren't fun. And I think sometimes now people think of poetry as kind of a puritanical thing, like a duty to your higher self, that you're supposed to appreciate poetry in a kind of a somber way. And people sometimes at a reading might look like they're sitting there in a church. But I'm all about it. Just feeling good, because to me, poetry is one of the most deliciously pleasurable, sensual, amazing things in the universe.
Jeanette Winterson, who's one of my favorite British writers, speaks so powerfully about that, about how, you know, you hear a lot of people say, well, I just don't understand poetry, or poetry's boring. And she said, actually, poetry saved her life. Yeah. And that's from her latest memoir that just came out, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal? Great title. So tell us a little bit more about the book of Among the Goddesses. We know that it includes a ritual at the end. Can you tell us a little bit more about, if people buy the book, what would they be getting? Because it's not just the choreo poem.
And there's a preface that tells the story of how the poem developed, which is quite a saga over decades. And you can read it, you can actually read the poem three different ways. You can read it just as a narrative poem, as the epic, the original epic, and then there's the dramatic version that you can read as well. So Red Hen Press published it, and it can be found on the Red Hen Press website. There's also a link on my website, anniefinch.com, and it's available as well on Amazon and in local bookstores.
Great. I was very struck by the role that Inanna plays in the excerpt that we just heard, and I know that you've written another poem about her. Could we hear that in the final few minutes of this show?
Yes.
Maybe you'd like to tell us a little bit about who Inanna was.
Yes, Inanna has a strong connection to poetry. She was a Sumerian goddess, a very powerful goddess of the Mediterranean, ancient Sumer. And the very first poems that we have recorded in writing with a name attached to them were written by a priestess of Inanna. The priestess was named Enheduanna. And this poem, Inanna, is written in the kind of measure that would have been used by a poet like Enheduanna. And the story of Inanna is basically the story of a descent into the underworld, and she had to go through seven gates in order to reach the underworld where her sister was waiting for her. Inanna, a young goddess, full of love, fresh with the touch of a husband, carrying power and rich with anger, strength, urgency, understanding, follows the direction her ear has led her, down to the place where the underworld glistens. At each door she removes a jewel, a belt, a ceremonial robe. At each door she is less and more. She bows down through the seventh door. The young goddess is dead and waiting. The young goddess is dead. A goddess goes down, and I can see her. She needs to go, decides to go. A goddess goes down, and I can hear her.
Mm. Thank you. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your words, your poetry, and your bright, courageous spirit with all of us today.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful pleasure to talk with you, Kate Johnson. So that's all for Poets Theater, a special edition today of All Together Now. This is Annie Finch. Charlene Spretnak will be back next week at this time when her guest will be the linguist George Lakoff.
Thank you so much.